At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session today, you can press star 1 to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'll turn the call over to Mr. Glenn Lamar. You may begin, sir.
Thank you, and thank you all for being here and for calling in, and apologize for the delay. We were trying to let more people call in, so there were a number of folks still in the phone queue. So, today's press briefing on H1N1 influenza is going to be conducted by Dr. Ann Schuchat. Dr. Schuchat is the director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases at CDC. She'll be providing an update on where we stand with respect to vaccine, as well as providing CDC's estimates related to the pandemic. First 6 months of the pandemic in the United States. So, Dr. Schuchat.
Thanks, Glenn, and good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to update you this afternoon. You know, since the emergence of the 2009 H1N1 virus, we've been talking about the laboratory-confirmed cases, hospitalizations, and deaths, potentially giving an incomplete picture of the story of this pandemic. And so today I'll be sharing estimates that we hope will provide a bigger picture of what's been going on in the first 6 months of the pandemic. I'm going to be sharing estimates for the picture through October 17th, and also I think that these estimates really stress how critical our vaccine recommendations are and the priority groups that we focused on. I'm going to touch on three areas. First, a quick update about the vaccine program. Secondly, highlighting one of the groups that's very hard hit with influenza complications, people with diabetes. And then lastly, I'll expand on the estimates that we have for you today. The picture of the vaccine supply first. Today we have 41.6 million doses of influenza vaccines that are available for the states to order. We believe that will be somewhat less than what the manufacturers had expected to have reached by this point. And it is just very difficult to predict with vaccine production for influenza. 41.6 million is more than we had before, but it's not as much as we had hoped to have by today. Again, it's an imperfect process, both producing vaccine and then projecting how many doses you'll have at any one point. Seasonal flu vaccine continues to be distributed. The update for today is that 94 million doses have been distributed of the seasonal flu vaccine. Last week it was 91 million, so that's continuing to progress. And the manufacturers have told us to expect 114 million doses of seasonal flu vaccine by the end of the year. And we'll see if we make that prediction that they've made for us. The immunization efforts with this supply continue to be focused on the target populations, the priority groups, pregnant women, healthcare workers, children and young adults up through age 24, adults 25 to 64 with chronic health conditions, and parents or other caretakers of newborns and children under 6 months of age. So those groups are really where the states and cities are focusing the vaccination efforts. We do expect and have seen a variety of approaches to getting vaccine into the path of where priority populations are. States and cities are really in the best position to know how to reach their populations. Many are doing school-located clinics, mass community clinics, providing vaccine to healthcare providers, hospitals, clinics, and some to employer-based clinics, a variety of approaches that really do make sense when you have as many groups to cover as we have. As the supply increases, we do think that access and convenience and ease of getting vaccinated will improve. It may take longer in some areas than others, but a reminder that all of the states are receiving an amount of vaccine that's proportionate to their population and trying to serve their populations as best as possible. Next, I want to turn to diabetes and flu. November is American Diabetes Month. And this is a chance for us to remember that diabetes is a common condition and that there's much that people with diabetes can do to improve their health, particularly in light of the H1N1 influenza challenges. People with diabetes have an increased risk of severe illness from any flu. And when people with diabetes get flu, it can be more difficult for them to manage their blood sugar. They can suffer high or low blood sugar. So paying special attention with flu when you have diabetes is important. People with diabetes account for about 12% of all of the hospitalizations we've seen from the H1N1 influenza virus. If we focus in on adults, 19% of those people who've been hospitalized have diabetes. We know that people hospitalized with H1N1 influenza who have diabetes have a good chance of ending up in the intensive care unit. 1 in 4 hospitalized patients with diabetes did require intensive care unit management. So this can be a very severe illness in people with diabetes. But there are several things that people with diabetes and their caretakers can do to improve their health during this difficult flu season. Certainly, we recommend that people with diabetes get vaccinated with the H1N1 influenza vaccine. They should receive the shot, not the nasal spray, and they should receive the vaccine as it becomes available in their communities. It's very important for people with diabetes to be vaccinated. People with diabetes who have fever and cough or other symptoms of respiratory illness like flu really do need to check with their healthcare providers because we recommend antiviral medicines, Tamiflu or Relenza, for people with diabetes who develop flu. It's not necessary to wait for the test results to come back on the influenza testing. It's just important to get prompt antiviral medicines. The third action step that diabetic patients can take in the face of this flu pandemic is to make sure that they've been vaccinated against pneumococcal infections. Pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine is recommended for adults who have chronic conditions like diabetes, and many people with diabetes and other chronic conditions have not been vaccinated with this pneumococcal vaccine. We have seen with influenza pneumonia, including pneumococcal pneumonia, following the influenza. So in this American Diabetes Month, we really remind people to take care of themselves with diabetes and get those two vaccines, as well as seeking care promptly to get antiviral medicines should they develop flu symptoms. Diabetes is just one of several chronic medical conditions that it can increase the complications of flu and that is recommended in the target population for H1N1 vaccine. Next, I want to share with you a little bit of background and the results of our method to estimate the big picture of how much pandemic influenza we have had in the first 6 months of this pandemic. Our estimates, we believe, give us a better estimate of how much disease, hospitalization, and death there is than we would get by just counting the individual laboratory-confirmed cases. These estimates, again, go from April, when this virus emerged, through October 17th, about a month ago, or literally the first 6 months of the pandemic. Our estimates derive from information from our Emerging Infection Program Network. This is a collaboration with 10 states, 62 counties in those 10 states, that collects extensive information on hospitalizations from influenza, including details about laboratory testing and age and so forth. The Emerging Infections Program Network is one key source for our estimates. We also are using data from other surveillance systems like the aggregate state reporting of laboratory-confirmed hospitalizations and deaths. So it's with those two surveillance systems primarily as a source that we are then extrapolating to the whole United States and to the entire period of this first 6 months. What I'm going to describe isn't a switch or a change from the way that we've been counting cases so far. What we're really trying to do is just give you a bigger picture. And as many of you know, we've been talking about planning to do this for some time, and we're finally ready. We've tried this a few different ways, and really the estimates converge, so we're feeling pretty comfortable that we'll be giving you appropriate estimates today. These estimates will give a single number and then a range, a lower and upper estimate around each number. And I want to tell you, everyone who's rapidly taking notes, that the numbers I'm going to give you are at our website under the CDC's website under the media information place. So for April through October 17th, we estimate that 22 million people have become ill from pandemic influenza. We estimate that 98,000 people have been hospitalized so far through October 17th. And the upper and lower estimates on hospitalizations are from 63,000 to 153,000. We estimate that 3,900 people have died so far in the first 6 months of the pandemic from this virus. And the estimates there are from 2,500 up through 6,100 people having died so far. We've been talking a lot about this pandemic being a younger person's disease, that it's disproportionately affecting children and young adults, and relatively sparing the elderly, very different from seasonal flu. So I also want to give you some estimates for cases, hospitalizations, and deaths for different age groups. So in children under 18, we estimate 8 million children have been ill with influenza, 36,000 hospitalized, and 540 children have died from this pandemic influenza. In the first 6 months of the pandemic, for adults 18 to 64 years of age, we estimate 12 million cases, 53,000 hospitalizations, and 2,900 deaths. For people 65 and over, we estimate about 2 million cases, 9,000 hospitalizations, and about 440 deaths. That's a lot of numbers, and again, I remind you that we've posted those numbers on our website so that you can look in more detail. The website also has additional information about the methods that were used to derive these estimates for those who are interested. We will be updating the toll that the pandemic has taken, these estimates, about every 3 to 4 weeks. We don't think we're going to be able to do this every week because it takes some time for the information to be filled in. There's chart reviews involved and other data collection. But we're expecting about every 3 to 4 weeks to be able to update you on the full illness, hospitalizations, and deaths that the virus has had. Going forward, we are making progress, and we know how important vaccination is. We appreciate the really hard work that the state and local health departments, the private healthcare provider community have been doing to put vaccine in the pathway of priority populations. Every dose of vaccine we get is critically important in protecting another individual. I want to thank the state and local public health workers who are really doing a tremendous job in the face of a very challenging pandemic. I know it's been challenging, and we're really there with you every step of the way, I hope. I want to also remind people that vaccine safety is a big priority for us. We are mounting a comprehensive effort to be aware and evaluate reports that we get. We haven't so far seen anything that is of concern or extra concern, but we're reviewing reports that we get every day, and we will be updating you on information when new information that's critical comes to light. We are going to continue to have challenges with this pandemic, and I think it's important for us all to remember it's a marathon and not a sprint. But more vaccine is being ordered and delivered and used every day, and that's very important because I think we all remember that it's the virus that's the enemy here, and it's what's bringing our challenges. But together, I am sure we will be able to get through this. So I'd like to now go to questions. I think we can start in the room. Mike?
Hi, Mike Stobie from the AP. Doctor, did you say 540 children?
Okay.
And you were reporting, what, about 120 recently? That's quite a jump, and I thought the CDC was keeping careful track of PD. Could you tell us a little more about how that number jumped so dramatically?
That's right. As of last Friday, we reported 129 children had been reported with laboratory-confirmed H1N1 influenza. Additional reports have come in about pediatric deaths from laboratory-confirmed influenza where typing information wasn't available. We know that a number of the deaths that we're seeing are occurring outside the hospital where testing is not possible. We know that not every patient with influenza gets a diagnosis of flu. For instance, many people can have a bacterial pneumonia following a flu illness and may or may not be recognized as having flu. We don't think things have changed from last week to this week. What we think is our 540 number is a better estimate for the big picture of what's out there. We think the individual reports that we're getting through the National Pediatric Death Notification System are vitally important. That system gives us additional detail about underlying diseases that children had, about issues like the bacterial pneumonia problem, and with that system, we think we can make sure that our guidelines are right and on track, but we do think that for influenza, it's virtually impossible to find every single case with a lab test, And so the estimation method that we are using now, we believe gives a bigger picture, probably a more accurate picture of the full scope of the pandemic. Another from the room?
Thank you, Dr. Shuka. Diana Davis from WSB in Atlanta. With these numbers seeming to triple literally overnight, should the public's level of concern be affected? I think it's fair to say when they hear this, they'll be quite alarmed. What is your message to the public, parents, and adults when they hear these new numbers?
Influenza is serious, and vaccination is the best method to protect oneself or one's family. These estimates give a bigger picture of what's going on, and they really reaffirm the priority recommendations that we've given. We've focused vaccination on younger people because they are disproportionately affected with the virus. So things haven't really changed from last week to this week. We just feel that we're finally able to update the public about how big a toll this virus is having so far. Of course, this is just the first 6 months, and I am expecting all of these numbers, unfortunately, to continue to rise. Back in the back, Joanne.
Hi, Joanne Flaberner from National Public Radio. Thank you. There is some resistance among some doctors out there to the vaccine. Do you have any idea how much resistance that is? Are you monitoring that? Do you have a sense of how many doctors are reluctant to recommend the vaccine?
We have been carrying out a number of different monitoring efforts, including some surveys of providers. You know, initially we were interested in whether providers were going to sign up to give out the H1N1 vaccine. And I have to say we have a very good uptake of providers that do want to be able to offer it. We don't necessarily have as many providers in every group that we're interested in. In particular, we've been really encouraging obstetrician gynecologists to offer influenza vaccine in general, including the H1N1 vaccine, because they reach such an important population. I hear the same reports that others do about individual providers that really are skeptical about the vaccine, and I just think it's critical for the consumer, the public, to get good information. Usually your healthcare provider is a good source, and what I would say is that influenza is really serious, and the vaccines that we have are the best way to protect patients.
But a sense of numbers, is it 1% of doctors, 10% of doctors? Do you have any sense of numbers?
No, I don't. Sorry. One from the phone, please.
If you have a question on the phone line, please press star 1. First question comes from Steve Smith with Boston Globe.
Hi, Dr. Shuka. Good afternoon. I have two questions. The first is regarding the pediatric death. This figure, this estimate of 540, that's several multiples higher than what has been seen in the previous seasons of influenza tracking. And so I'm wondering at this point, are you able to say definitively that this pathogen is producing more serious illness in more children than seasonal strains that we've seen since 2004 when the tracking began more earnest? And then secondly, an unrelated question, I'm wondering what you are hearing about Tamiflu stockpiling. Business community, and what your concerns are about inappropriate spending.
Thanks for both of those questions. It's important to compare apples to apples. The pediatric death reporting that was initiated in 2004 focuses in on children who have had a laboratory-confirmed influenza infection, and looking at the same system, the pediatric death reporting, not the estimation method, we have already seen a larger number of deaths than we've had for several years. I do believe that the pediatric death toll from this pandemic will be extensive and much greater than what we see with seasonal flu, but it would be better to compare our 129 number with the previous years of around 40 to 88 or so deaths each year than to look in on that 540 number. There are many ways that we talk about the toll that seasonal flu has on the population. Often those are derived from models or from retrospective reviews of data. When we talk about 36,000 deaths, 90% of which occurs in seniors, those figures would be more comparable to what we're talking about here with our estimation method, although those are derived from a different approach than what we're describing. So if you think about that, that only about 10% of the seasonal flu deaths occur in people under 65, that would be about 3,600 deaths. We do think that we are having a pretty severe amount of deaths so far from this H1N1 virus. And, of course, we're only the numbers I'm giving are only through the first 6 months, through the middle of October. And we have had a lot of disease since then, and we'll probably have a lot of disease going forward, hopefully much of it mitigated by our vaccination effort. Your second question was about Tamiflu stockpiles in the business community. And I want to mention to people that for several years there's been a lot of pandemic preparedness efforts going forward. The states, the cities, the business community, the public and private sector really looked into their own midst and tried to figure out how can we be ready when something happens. From my knowledge, I believe that a number of companies actually looked at what to expect and thought maybe we better get ahead of this and prepare some antiviral stockpiles for our workers as really that private-public partnership responsibility. I don't have updated information about how many businesses have done that, but I believe that practice started several years ago with all of the preparations around the H5N1 bird flu situation. Another one from the phone.
And that comes from Steve Sternberg with USA Today. You may ask your question.
Hi, Dr. Shuchat. There's an echo on this line. It's a little hard to hear, but I wanted to ask you about the science, how states are deciding whom to vaccinate against the backdrop of this vaccine shortage. Which of the priority groups is of highest priority given the estimates you've seen now?
Thank you. The question's about priority groups and whether there's any sub-priorities that are more important than others. The Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices met in July and came up with target populations that accounted for about half of the U.S. population. And then they also went through a sub-prioritization effort where they came up with a smaller group of people. When we survey the states and large cities about how they're addressing the target populations, some of them are focusing on that sub-priority groups. It was about a 42 million total population targeted, and it involved children 6 months of age through 5 years, and then 5-year-olds to 18-year-olds who had chronic conditions, not all healthy school-aged children. It didn't involve people 19 or 18 to 20 to 65 who had chronic health conditions. It did include healthcare workers. It did include pregnant women. It did include parents or caretakers of young babies. And basically, by excluding the healthy school-aged children and the chronically ill adults, you got to a much smaller population. One of the problems with that sub-priority effort is that not all vaccine formulations can be given to everyone. About a fourth of the vaccine supply that we have right now is live attenuated vaccine or the nasal spray, and that can only be given to people who are healthy and between the ages of 2 and 49. So some of the states and cities found if they focused too much on that sub-priority group, they couldn't really optimally use their formulations. We have not given strict recommendations that states need to do the subgroups or the total groups. What we had heard from the states and provider community was that it was important for them to have flexibility. We do know from surveying the cities and county health departments that the vast majority are reaching out to priority populations through providers who serve them, through hospitals, through mass clinics that initially are targeting young people and pregnant women, and through some specialty clinics that would reach people with asthma, diabetes, cancer, and so forth. So there's a mix of activities out there, which is probably very good because a rural area and a city really could not be served by exactly the same method. Places with large health plans are getting vaccine and able to target to their population that has those underlying conditions, but really just a variety of efforts are out there. Another thing to say is that going forward, as we get more and more vaccine each day, the risk of focusing too narrowly may mean that you're not able to address using all the doses that you get. We know that in the first couple weeks, many states were turning people away who were online because there just wasn't enough vaccine at those clinics for all of them to be covered, and they really focused on just the people in line who were in the priority groups. Another question from the room here.
Hi, Dominique Marie for the French TV. In France, the vaccination just started yesterday. but only 20% of the population want to get vaccinated. In the United States, people are queuing for the vaccine, so what do you think of that first? And then the FDA and the CDC say the vaccine is safe, but some people, some doctor, some specialists, say it was made in rush. The time was too short to really test it. And more than that, the pharmaceutical company asked the government not to be prosecuted in case of serious side effects. So how can we trust you if even the pharmaceutical company are not really 100% sure about their vaccine?
Yeah. Thank you for those questions. The consumer demand for vaccines varies substantially, and so it doesn't surprise me that in France the general population interest in vaccine is different from our general interest here in the U.S. Even here in the U.S., community to community or week to week, we have seen some variations. We have had a lot of disease here in the U.S., and of course it started earlier here before it was the problem in France, and so it doesn't surprise me that Americans in general are more concerned and more interested in being vaccinated. We also have a very high immunization coverage rate in the United States, and so parents in particular are used to getting their children vaccinated against life-threatening diseases. So I think all of that is good news. On the other hand, as you mentioned, there are many in France and here who wonder about the safety of vaccine, and what we really say over and over again is what we know. We know that these vaccines are being made exactly the same way as seasonal flu vaccines. In the U.S., about 100 million people get seasonal flu vaccine each year. They have a very good safety track record. But we know that no medical intervention can be promised to be 100% safe. And so we have enhanced our safety monitoring system so that we can be ready if there are problems, so that we find them quickly and take action quickly. And I think the most important thing for consumers here or in France is that we are as transparent as possible with what we know when we know it. And I can say at CDC and at HHS we're really committed to that. A question from the phone?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Daniel Noon with WebMD. You may ask your question.
Thank you for taking my question. Dr. Shukadin, the MMWR, the CDC's editorial, talks about the numbers that have been reported from August 31st through the end of October, and talks about flu activity being substantially above historic levels, and talks about ILI visits higher than observed at the peak of any seasonal flu season since record-keeping began. Can you put this in perspective about what does historical levels mean here?
We've been tracking influenza for decades, and we have some systems that go back really to 1958. Others of our systems are newer. But what we are seeing in 2009 is unprecedented. As people know, we haven't had a pandemic since 1957, so it's not surprising that what we're seeing is unprecedented. To have very high rates of influenza-like illness in September and October is extremely unusual. And so I think the report in the MMWR really focuses in on that. If we look back year after year, we don't see a fall like this. Another question from the phone?
Thank you. And that comes from Karen Garlow with the Chart Observer. You may ask your question.
Thank you, Dr. Shukla, for taking my question. Back to the issue of the high-risk groups, we've had some little bit of controversy in our community because some of the clinics have offered the vaccine to healthy people, even though they were targeting high-risk groups. When healthy people came through, they were given, or they opened it up a little bit to parents of children or faculty instead of students. And the health officials here say that is okay with the CDC. They have said not to turn people away. Is that what you would say to people who are worried about not getting it in the high-risk group?
This is a really challenging issue. In general, we think that vaccine that is not given doesn't do anybody any good. But being able to regulate the supply and demand match is really a local matter. So the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices and CDC guidance is really for local and state and healthcare providers to do the best that they can to vaccinate people in the priority groups. And when the priority groups have been met, the demand in that group has been met, to continue to vaccinate others. Now, in some communities, there's been very little demand for vaccine among the priority groups. Two key things there. We recommend urging, better outreach to the priority population so they are well-informed about how to be vaccinated and about the risks and benefits therein. But we also think that there may be some places where additional people can be vaccinated more promptly. One of the key features, I think, in the public health community is to focus on vaccinating and not on turning people away and putting the bulk of the effort into getting the people who need to be vaccinated vaccinated. There's a variety of practices out there, and we are really trying to support the states and cities in managing this. In an individual provider office, the vaccines are being given according to our advisory committee immunization for immunization practices recommendations, but we're not in there policing what each doctor is doing. Next question from the phone.
That comes from Lisa Sneering with Advanced News. You may ask your question.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my question. I know that last week the CDC predicted at the last press briefing that 8 million more doses would be available in the next week, and I'm just wondering how much less did we actually get over the week, and is there a reason, if you're hearing from the manufacturers of another problem, or just wondering if you could characterize why it's less and how much is it less?
Yes, thanks. Last week we did mention that we had been led to expect about 8 million doses this week, and based on what we have today, we aren't expecting to meet that estimate that the manufacturers gave us. I think there are a variety of reasons that it's difficult to be exactly right in terms of what the manufacturers expect to have from week to week. Some of the steps involved with vaccine production happen really at the last minute. There's lot release testing that's really one of the last steps you do before the vaccine can leave the plant. And if the lot release results come out a certain way, everything goes forward, and if they come out other ways, you need to look into things a little bit in more detail. There's also transport. When something leaves the manufacturers, it needs to get shipped to where it's going, and sometimes the shipping doesn't go perfectly. We're told that a little bit of a problem might have been some side effects of the storm that some of the country went through and slower shipping. But I think it is really challenging, and going forward, one of the reasons we haven't wanted to project weeks into the future is because it's very difficult to be right. So this week we are expecting that we will not receive 8 million doses. We're expecting it to be substantially less than that that comes in by the end of tomorrow, but I won't know till tomorrow what comes in. Time for another question from the room. Do we have one? Maybe not? Okay. Then I guess time for one more question from the phone.
Thank you. That comes from Stacey Singer with Palm Beach Post. You may ask your question.
Hi, thank you. I'd like to hear a little bit more about the methodology you used to arrive at the new figures, as much as you can tell me. And also, I would like to know if the new figures give you better information about the death rate of this particular strain of pandemic flu and how it would compare to previous pandemics. Thank you.
Yeah, let me sketch out the methods in some detail, but there'll be a lot more detail on the web. We've posted a summary of the detailed methods for people to pore over. Essentially, we're using the Emerging Infection Program Network as our first source for hospitalization data. We correct the numbers that we get from the Emerging Infection Program Network based on under detection. That would be things like a person's in the hospital for flu, but they don't get a test for flu, so they can't be lab confirmed, or they get a test for flu, but the test says that they don't have flu. We know the tests aren't perfectly accurate, so a certain number of patients really who do have H1N1 flu have a negative test result. Those are the sorts of correction factors. Then what we do is look at a ratio of hospitalizations to deaths, and we get that ratio of hospitalizations to deaths from our aggregate hospitalization and death reporting activity that about 30 of the states are contributing to. That helps us know if we have this many hospitalizations, how many deaths should we have, and we're actually doing that adjustment for different age groups to be as precise as we can. And so that's really how we go from hospitalizations in the Emerging Infection Program Network to correct for under detection to nationalize in terms of the full population and then to adjust for the death to hospitalization ratio. To get the case figures, we actually use essentially a reporting factor that we published in a paper by Carrie Reed and others in the Emerging Infectious Diseases Journal that talked about, you know, if you have this many hospitalizations, how many cases might you have. I think it's a factor of about 222, and that's because not everybody who's ill seeks care, not everybody who's ill gets hospitalized. You know, we know that there's quite a lot of illness out there that doesn't lead to hospitalization. In terms of the way to relate what we're seeing in death to previous pandemics in terms of a death rate, I don't actually have that answer for you, and we can look into that and see if we can get you that in a follow-up. So I think that was the question. Okay. Oh, okay. So I'm sorry. Okay. I must have not understood the question. So the question about, you know, what does this look like compared to previous pandemics? First thing I need to say is that the estimates I'm giving you are the first 6 months, and this is, you know, April through the middle of October. We have a long flu season ahead of us. In typical seasonal flu, we see disease from December to May. It's only November. So exactly what we will see as the full toll of illness from this pandemic is very difficult to say. I can say, though, that what we're seeing with this H1N1 virus is nowhere near the severity of the 1918 pandemic. That caused much larger numbers even, you know, 6 months in. But I think projecting out forward is difficult, and we're really keen to get vaccine given as rapidly as possible to those in greatest need so that we can limit the full toll that this pandemic takes. So I think, thank you, everybody.
Thank you for calling the Digital Replay Service.